people want to quietly leave, that's fine, but those who are here can continue. So let me formally welcome Professor Klüster both to the center, this being the first seminars of the center, and also this is the first time he is going to speak here, and also as the speaker for today. I don't think he needs much introduction because he's a well-known Indologist and a grammarian, and he is very well known in Asian studies in general, but particularly in South Asian studies. Perhaps he is more known in the outside India, I would imagine, than India. Or, I mean, I'm sure he would be known in India, but he has made substantial name outside as a serious Indology scholar, and his work spanned a number of things, mainly around grammatical texts. And today he's going to talk to us about some of those ideas in relation to what he has titled Semantic History of Vedanta and Its Implications for the Study of Indian Philosophy. And I'm myself particularly interested in that twist that he indicated here in his, those of you who have this this thing might have seen the little abstract. I would be very interested as to how he would develop that argument, and as I see it, it will have substantial implications as to how we understand not only Vedanta as a system of philosophy, but also the whole range of texts that we have come to associate as Aranyakas and Upanishads in relation to the Vedic Sanghitas and Brahmanas and so on. So it's now up to you, Professor. So welcome again.
Thank you very much.
And so when you finish, then we will have 10 or 15 minutes formal kind of this thing, and then, and then we can inform the camera.
I have been working on this theme for a number of years now. It began to bother my mind in a rather surprising way, as many things in research do. I was reading Bharatriya's Vakyapadiya, the Vritti, and there came a line that Shruti Smriti Trayanta Adipyaha. The line had this word, Shruti Smriti Trayanta Adipyaha. The normal tendency is to say Trayi is Veda, therefore Trayanta must be Vedanta, and therefore he is saying Shruti Smriti Vedante Pyaha. Then it suddenly occurred to me, why is he distinguishing between Shruti and Vedanta? There are two possibilities. Either the meanings of Shruti and Veda are different for him, or Vedanta or Trayanta is not really a part of Shruti in his thinking. These are the two possibilities that occurred to me. And then I began to think of other occurrences of Vedanta I had come across. As someone who had first specialized in at a very preliminary level in Shankara Vedanta in my traditional school, it never occurred to me that Vedanta could be interpreted in a different way. But here it was an odd line that first of all forced me to think of Trayanta in a different way, and then forced me to concentrate my thinking on Vedanta. And then going through my whatever texts immediately were known to me, I began to notice a number of oddities. And so one message of this talk is that we should always look at the odd piece of evidence. This is true in science, as we frequently know. A scientist leaves something overnight in his lab, and next day he discovers invents a bouncing ball or penicillin or radioactive substances. You know, these are well-known stories in science. In Indology, however, because there is a paucity of materials on the history of ancient India, Indologists, it seems to me, are very much in a synthesizing mode all the time. That is, when they see different pieces of evidence, the first impulse is to reconcile them and to smooth over the rough edges, which I think is has gone too far in many ways. That is, we should always try to see the cumulative strength of any evidence, but to ignore the literal meanings of terms to what the text literally says is frequently very misleading and harmful to the field. So that is really the sort of autobiographical background of this discussion and the message also of this discussion. Now, I have given you a rather long handout, and I don't expect you to read all the passages that have been given there. I naturally began to look at different explanations of the term Vedanta. The first thing, of course, was to go to the authors, researchers, who have particularly, specifically written on Vedanta, say Dasgupta's history, Dyson's work, Karl Potter's recent work, and so on. So I began to go through a number of those discussions. There is no end to collecting these passages, particularly because Advaita Vedanta is a field which has suffered from a great deal of repetition at the popular level. That is, it's just too much literature at the popular level, which is understandable, but which makes the researcher's job rather difficult. So my strategy was, first of all, to go to what the specialists have written, and then whenever I find time, to consult other things. The second group of texts I consulted was the respectable dictionaries of Sanskrit, Prakrit, Pali, etc. That's where the material comes from. Now, for your convenience and my convenience, what I have done is to give an outline of what the scholars have said. So it's really item 2 in the handout to which you should turn. And this was a discovery for me too. That is, I had thought that almost everyone was saying, the end of the Veda, concluding part of the Veda, chronologically the last part that came to be added to the canon or body of scriptures or body of authoritative text that we call Veda. I'm using the word canon in a rather loose sense. The Brahma Sutras or Vedanta Sutras tried to apply certain hermeneutical principles to these early texts and gave us some thesis, some observations, some equations. And then we have authors like Gaudapada and Shankara, with whom the system of Vedanta as a philosophical school begins to take shape. In the first stage of transition from the Upanishads to, say, the Brahma Sutra, I did not expect to find a great deal of divergence of opinion or uncertainty. And what you have under handout item 2 is really an ironical situation. On the one hand, you have scholars writing very confidently that from the term Vedanta as applied to the Upanishads or the concluding part of the Veda in some sense, we can move to the Vedanta Sutras and Vedanta as systematized by Shankara, Ramanuja, and so on. There is a great deal of confidence. There is no questioning of that. And then on the other side, you have the same scholars giving 2 or 3 interpretations of what it could mean to be at the end, to be the last, but not telling the readers that they are actually giving alternative interpretations of the same simple Sanskrit word, anta. This was a discovery in itself. except for Doyson, who was sort of very first author to write on this problem, the textbook authors Chatterjee and Datta, whose textbook for Indian philosophy has been used in Indian colleges and universities for many, many generations. A textbook we would now consider very simplistic. But except for these two sources, there is no clear acknowledgement of the fact that different interpretations are being attached to the word anta. This is what I generally found. And so this is ironical in a way. On the one hand, you have a sense, a very great assurance with what the author is saying, a confidence. And on the other hand, you have two or three meanings given, interpretations given, without saying that they can come into conflict with each other. Now, I hope you just have a glance at my arrangement of what these passages say, and then let me read to save time. The citations have at least three intriguing aspects. A, no scholar has questioned the propositions that the Upanishads represent the unsystematic Vedanta thought from which Vedanta as a system derives its content and authentication, and that the Upanishads were the end texts or the last texts. But no scholar has asked, in what sense can the Upanishads be justifiably last? That is, could the Upanishads really have been at the spatial or chronological end in the perception of the ancient Vedic organizers of the canon? Are the reasons given or implied to make such a perception plausible really valid reasons? B. In what Doyson, Dasgupta, Kale, Apte, Devdar, Chatterjee Datta, and Dandekar have written, there is clearly a suggestion or explicit acknowledgement of the possibility that the end meant when the context is that of determining the earliest accessible meaning of Vedanta as a specialized term could be understood in more than one way. Yet no scholar has tried to determine which one of these ways is better or the best. In fact, Potter and Richard King, and perhaps some others, have written as if the possibility of multiple understandings of the literal meaning does not exist. Even those who have made us aware of the possibility, with the exception of Doyson, as I said, are not expressing or indicating the possibility itself of multiple interpretation. C. The possibility that a meaning-like conclusion of the Veda, not in a spatial or chronological sense, but in a logical, hermeneutical, philosophical, or theoretical sense, more like ultimate message or teaching of the Veda, that such a meaning could have been the real meaning of the term Vedanta, even in its very first use, has been mentioned by Doyson with the words dogmas of the Veda. Most of our subsequent sources show awareness of that meaning with expressions such as Brahma Vidya, final authority or metaphysic on metaphysics, ultimate aim and scope, culminating phase of Vedic thought, meaning of life, mystery of the universe, culmination of the Vedic speculation, mystical and philosophical culmination, and final stage in the development of the Vedic religious thought. However, no later scholar has apparently thought it possible that a meaning akin to what the listed expressions convey could belong to Vedanta, even in the initial stage of its usage. With Doyson's rejection of dogmas of the Veda, all meanings coming close to it became untouchable, like the sons of Vishwamitra. The three curious aspects I have pointed out just now should constitute sufficient justification for my taking up the topic. However, I'm not going to stop with just one such essentially negative justification, perhaps because I have 50 minutes here. But as my exposition unfolds, it will increasingly indicate that there are other stronger justifications. I list some of these now. None of the ways in which being at the end has been taken or interpreted so far for the first occurrences of the term Vedanta is really satisfactory. This is what I'll try to demonstrate. The proposition that the Upanishads were at the end or were thought to be fit for the end needs to be questioned. The proposition that the Upanishads, to the extent they overlapped with the early Vedanta texts, were unsystematic needs to be modified to some extent. They may not be as systematic as later works, but there is a system, there is a comment on earlier parts of the Veda in them. And, I will not have much time for that, but let's hope we will see it in the introduction, in the question and answer discussion. It is obvious that most of the Upanishads are at the end of some other Veda text or betray through their language a time of composition later than that of the Samhitas and the Brahmanas. Logically, therefore, the possibility that they were called Vedanta because they formed an end of Veda in a spatial sense exists. However, a deeper consideration of how they got there and if the reference of Upanishad and Vedanta were the same from the beginning needs to be investigated. A deeper consideration is warranted, needs to be carried out. The phenomenon of attaching later texts at the end of an inherited body of canonical, scriptural, or authoritative texts is widely noticed. Usually the process is this. The authoritative text, frequently considered to be revealed, stands in need of full or partial explication for various reasons. Its language or thought becoming difficult to understand or its arrangement becoming inconvenient seem to be the common reasons. The explication is offered in various formal and informal ways. Sometimes it is preserved in the explicator's own words, written or taken down in writing by someone. Sometimes a person or body of persons collects the explications offered at different times by informed or thought to be informed inheritors of the tradition. In the course of time, the explication texts become authoritative in their own right, again for various reasons, but usually the explicator's high standing in the inheriting community is the reason. The distinction between the revealed text or texts and the explicating text is gradually effaced, the distance between the two is gradually reduced, and an explicating text of time T2 sits in the same rank as the revealed text of time T1. There is no reason why we as historians should think of the Vedic tradition as being immune to this process. Witnessed among other traditions in the Buddhist, for example, recall the inclusion of Kathavattu in the Pali canon, or the Jain texts, where one of the reasons for the Digambara Shvetambara split was how much to include in the Agama. The process has been borne out by much, although not adequate or invariably sound research, by a number of scholars over the last 200 years. I will therefore not be so foolhardy as to say that there is no chronological dimension to the replacement of the Upanishads as it has come down to us. Yet the question remains, if they as texts were thought of as Vedanta when the replacement occurred. With these clarifications, let me come to specifying where modern research, in my view, has gone wrong in reconstructing the career of the term Vedanta. In the reconstructions outlined on handout item 2, to effect a connection between the meaning of Vedanta as a system name, implying a claim to the final view or message of the Veda, our researchers have implicitly made 4 assumptions. A. This meaning must have a very literal meaning of Anta as its basis. B. The literal meaning must be physical in nature, for usually abstract meanings connectable to physical things happenings or states are seen to be later than the latter. That is, the physical meanings usually come first, the abstract meanings come later. That is the general assumption. Semantical change moves from the concrete and the perceptible to the abstract, is the principle many researchers accept. C, a superior product usually appears later in time. D, the reference range of Upanishad and Vedanta was the same when the word Vedanta came into existence. There is nothing wrong with these assumptions in themselves, yet one must ascertain if they hold good when the philological evidence and religious psychology are taken into account. Normally, no strictly temporal divisions are seen by believers in a scripture. Now begins my critique. At the most, a scripture can be viewed by them as having parts revealed at different times. But by its very nature and expected function, it cannot have temporal parts such that a later part, simply because it appeared later, cancels or supersedes an earlier part. Newer is better may work as an underlying assumption in advertisements of detergents, etc. If the same assumption is made in the case of scriptures supposed to come from a perfect source, the implication would be that the perfect source was not really perfect when it delivered the earlier part. However, since perfection cannot accommodate a recall provision, the only way later is better type of view can be maintained in the case of scriptures is by relegating the earlier to a different level or sphere, that is, by declaring the earlier to be perfect for what it was intended for, by confining the earlier to a particular mission, for example, the division of Karma Kanda and Jnana Kanda, or Shravakayana, Hinayana, Mahayana, or you can say Old Testament, New Testament. The purpose has to be different. Its relatively low standing then is really that of its alleged mission or purpose, not of its own design or composition, which is as perfect as ever. That is, those who uphold the Upanishads are not going to say that the Brahmanas are imperfect for the function they were supposed to serve. Thus, from a believer's point of view, the Upanishads could at the most have been viewed as revealed later, but they could not have been on that score alone without the addition of Adhikari Bheda, or claim of being the final message, thought of as making the end of the physical Veda. In other words, the literal meaning of Veda Anta could not have been applicable to them when they began to be called Vedanta. It may, there are a couple of minor points which I will drop in the interest of time. I may be asked if the argument I have offered is not contradicted by the traditional explanations of Vedanta. These you have in the, I think, handout item 4. Are there not any pre-modern authors or modern pundits who have explained the term Vedanta? Yes, there are, albeit the pre-modern authors are not far removed from the modern age. This is again a very interesting thing. The ones I could discover are relatively late authors. Earlier authors don't seem to have felt the need to give an etymological definition of Vedanta, then connecting it to Vedanta as a philosophical school. Sadananda in Vedanta Sara derives, like modern scholars, the term Vedanta as it applies to the Brahma Sutras or Sharirika Mimamsa. I will not read the text that you have there, and we'll say also the same thing about Taranath Bhattacharya and Bhimacharya Jharkhikar. The outcome of this, these three citations is, we find the traditional scholars primarily thinking in terms of content and building into their explanations the claim that Vedanta as a system is a restatement of the Upanishads. Their explanations are intimations of the modern explanations mentioning existence at the end of a library of texts, but they do not employ words indicating a difference of time. If they had a notion of chronology with respect to Sanskrit, if they noticed that the language of the Upanishads was relatively late, and if they had concluded that the Upanishads for that reason must be later texts, they have managed to hide that thinking from us. When they make statements conveying or implying that the Upanishads are at the top, they do not proceed from a premise of historically or chronologically proven superiority. I have already dropped two hints as to the lack of semantic coextensiveness of Upanishad and Vedanta at an early time. I have observed that Vedanta, in its literal meaning, could not have been applicable to the Upanishads, and that the non-Vedic or non-sacred applications of Upanishad continue in later times, establishing that the word always had potential to be useful outside the Veda complex of texts. We find Upanishad applied to what are basically Smriti texts like the Gita. We find it applied to chapters of the Arthashastra and Kama Sutra. You know, so the word continues to expand in what it covers. So I put it this way. Vedanta the husband, which happens to be a masculine word, Vedanta the husband did not come in the way of Upanishad the wife in having her own professional independence. Okay. So that's what you see. Now, let us note this. Vedanta, even in its metaphorical sense, conclusion or ultimate teaching of the Veda, could not have been applied to the Upanishads as texts when the Vedic canon was settling. The followers of the Vedic tradition could have coined the name Vedanta only after an evaluation of the acknowledged sections in the body of their scriptures had taken place. One cannot come up with a relative ranking that is implicit in final message or ultimate teaching when what is to be evaluated is not present as a settled reality. Those who were fencing the Veda at some time, saying, this is the extent of the Veda literature, nothing more. Those who were fencing the Veda would have no way of knowing that a limit of knowing had been reached, that no superior knowledge was forthcoming. If they were to make any pronouncement to that effect, it would have been like a grandfather predicting a bleak future for the family and saying, my son, grandson, no one is going to be as good as I am. On the other hand, to join a canon, a text usually needs to acquire some uncommon importance. This can only come from its content or its amenability to a label that already carries considerable prestige. That is because of its association with literature that has a significant mission associated with it. Thus, when the Upanishads were incorporated in the earlier Veda body, either their association with Vedanta in the sense, conclusive part, ultimate teaching must exist, or their own designation, Upanishad, must unequivocally convey that meaning. Something of great importance to the Vedic tradition. We have already noted the unlikelihood of Upanishad having a narrow Veda-confined meaning. The probability, therefore, is that the final placing of the Upanishads as texts is due to their having been viewed as containing Vedanta, in the sense, the ultimate teaching of the Veda, and not that the Upanishads were called Vedanta because they appeared at the end of the Veda body. These are my sort of abstract arguments based on what happens generally in the case of scriptures and how religious psychology works. Now I come to the philological evidence. What I'm suggesting is the process has been more complex than what scholars have suspected so far it to be, but there are traces left in the tradition. And this is what I would have wished to give you on the handout, but I didn't have time. A passage that is common to Gautama Dharma Sutra, 19.11.13, Baudhayana Dharma Sutra, Vasishta Dharma Shastra, and is thus likely to come from a considerably ancient time, reads, Upanishado Vedantaha or Vedantaha, Sarvachandasu or Sarvachandasu Samhita or Sarvachandas Samhita. There are two different readings. And then it is followed by a long list of Vedic suktas, especially important samans, and so on. In Olivelle's translation, this passage reads, "The expiations for such a man," this is prescribed in the context of general penances, of someone who has done a wrong, either of omission or commission, that is not very serious, and about which the Dharma Shastra authors differ whether some kind of expiation is really called for. And Gautama then says these are relatively mild expiatory acts. "The expiations for such a man are softly reciting prayers," and he says, "austerity, ritual offering, fasting and giving gifts." And then in expanding on prayers, Upanishads, the conclusions of the Veda, that is Vedanta. That's Oliver's translation, which is, I suppose, deliberately ambiguous. The hymn collections of all the Vedas, the Hani verses, the Aghamarshana hymn, and so on, the Purusha Sukta, the long list is given. The passage lists Vedanta and Upanishad alongside, making it impossible that the two could be identical. That is, referring to that they could be identical by referring to two aspects of the same physical body of text, but that's not indicated in the context at all. But they are listed one after the other, so they have to have something in common. So they are close in the religious worldview of the time, but they are still thought to be distinct. Additionally, there are several passages according to which Vedanta cannot be a text within the Veda text corpus, and that the authors of the Vedanta text must be human. There are indications of both these facts in a number of texts. And here, when I said in the beginning that after I became aware of the odd reference of Trayanta and other things, and I began to think of how many things, where have I come across Vedanta? And it suddenly occurred to me, a line I must have read hundreds of times, but the oddity of which never struck me. In the Gita, Krishna says, Vedanta krud veda videva chaham. Okay? Now this is strange, that is Vedanta krud and veda vid. So, there is an indication of Vedanta originally being some kind of human-made text that gradually got attached to the Vedic canon. And then when I began to look, there are several references. The oldest reference, according to our traditional way of arranging the relative chronology of texts, would be Taittiriya Aranyaka. But it comes at the end of the Aranyaka. It's repeated in the Mahanarayani Upanishad, Mundaka, Shvetashvatra, etc. So it could be a floating verse that got attached to the Taittiriya Aranyaka. But it says, Yo Vedado Swarah Prokto Vedante Cha Pratishthitaha. Again, Veda and Vedanta are separated. Mahabharata has several lines. One in the form coming from the Gita I already referred to. Mahabharata 12:54-19. Vedoktaschaiva ye dharma, Vedanta nihitaschaye. So the dharmas which are proclaimed in the Veda, but which have been literally placed in the Vedanta. Then another passage, Sanyasa eva Vedante vartate japanam prati, Vedavadabhinivritta shantir brahmanyavastito. And then he, again you see here distinction between Vedanta and Veda. And there are about 5-6 such passages in the Mahabharata. Brihad Yogi Yajnavalkya Smriti, it has, Vedanshchaiva tu Vedangan. Okay, this should be really Vedantan at this point. And Vedantani Tatha Smritihi. That is, just the words have changed place. The printed text reads, Vedanshchaiva tu Vedangan Vedantani Tatha Smritihi. Now, Vedanga has to be in the neuter, and Vedanta has to be in the masculine. And the readings actually exist in manuscripts, other manuscripts. Anyway, for our purpose, whatever the gender of the word may be, Veda and Vedanta are distinguished in Brihad Yogi Yajnavalkya Smriti. you also see that drush is not associated with Vedanta sometimes. Mahabharata again says, yattan maharshivir drishtam vedanteshu cha giyate. So maharshis are associated with darshan, as is very common in the Indian tradition. But vedanteshu cha giyate, and there has to be some significant difference of concept to be required to use two different verbs. Again, here you find three or four passages in the Mahabharata doing exactly the same thing. The Jain canon, in the Sthananga Sutra, you have Vedanta used in the sense of a conclusion that arises from Rigveda, etc. Okay, this is an early Jain text. Then we come to an oddity with which I will deal later on. But this is the first text said so far to be discussing Vedanta as a philosophical system. This is Bhavivekas or Bhavavivekas or Bhavya's text in Madhyamika philosophy. And there in this, there is a commentary called Tarkajwala also on it. And in this text, the approach of Bhavya seems ambiguous to the scholar who has studied that particular chapter, well, Farnstrom. And he points out that at some in some places, Bhavya seems to be refuting Gaudapada. At some other places, he goes to an Upanishad like Ishavasya Upanishad. So there doesn't seem to be a clear distinction between systematic Vedanta texts, what we would call systematic Vedanta texts, and the Upanishads in Bhavya's mind. So this is an oddity, which in my view shows a fluid state in between, when the referent of the word Vedanta was slowly changing. It had not, the new idea had not arisen all over India. In some parts, maybe the older fluidity existed. Sometimes you have a passage coming from a relatively late author where this is indicated. There is a commentator Shripati who comments on the Vedanta Sutra or Brahma Sutra. He explains Sarvajna, the all-knowing person, the omniscient one, as Sarva Veda Vedantokta Sakala Padartha Vidya. Again, Veda and Vedanta are separated even at a later time. So the tradition at one point could have been relatively widespread. Now, coming back to where I started, I was investigating the word Trayanta also. And there are very few occurrences of the word Trayanta, although there are many occurrences of the word Trayi. And I first of all thought that Trayanta must be exact synonym of Vedanta. But in Bhartrihari's writing, the word Vedanta doesn't occur. In the verse part as well as the commentary part, he sticks to Trayanta, although he uses the word Veda elsewhere quite frequently. So there must be a special connotation of that word. I have not been able to determine it with great deal of certainty, but I collected as many occurrences as I could. And it seems that the authors among the five Vedanta schools who, as distinct from Shankara's tradition, thought of the Purva Mimamsa and Uttara Mimamsa as forming one Shastra, one school, are rather partial to the word Trayanta. That is, other than Bhartrihari, in the texts of the Ramanuja Vishishtadvaita school, you find Trayanta occurring more frequently. And that may be one connotation possible, although, I'm not entirely sure about it. If we look at the probably contemporary uses of other compounds containing Anta as the second member, then again we see a similar phenomenon, not, I don't mean of different connotation, but anta being used in the sense of conclusion, final thesis, outcome of something. And for example, the word karmanta, which occurs in the Mahabharata as well as in kammanta in Pali, which it's more like a result of the action or well-considered action, whatever, I don't know, but it's simply not karma itself. Then anta becomes meaningless. So that's in the Mahabharata, and there is a very strange usage in the epigraphs of the word, this karmanta word also. It's used for a storehouse. And karmantika, an adjective derived from it, is one who looks after such a storage facility and so on. So we have one possibility there. Sutranta, as implicit in Sautrantika, cannot possibly mean just the ends of the sutras, the concluding part of the sutras. It has more likely whatever meaning, whatever essence is derived from the sutras, whatever the final teaching of the sutras as seen by this Buddhist school is, although we may differ as to what exactly they saw. Another interesting piece of evidence is in the early tradition, Veda and Aranyaka, Aranyakas, which are considered to be the forerunners of the Upanishads, are distinguished. This is again Mahabharata, Veda Vadan Atikramya Shastranyaranyakanicha. And in the earlier passage, Gautama Dharma Sutra passage I quoted, the commentator Maskarin, he glosses Upanishadah with Aranyakani. So he probably had historical knowledge about what Gautama's view could have been, in the tradition of commentators, which is quite remarkable. Similarly, in Mahabharata 12.3.26.8, Sheshebhyaschaiva Vaktrebhyas Chaturvedodgatam Vasu Aranyakam Jagau Devo Harir Narayano Vashi. Again, Veda and Aranyaka have been distinguished. And there are three more passages doing exactly the same thing. So, we have, I think, considerable philological evidence of how the Vedic canon grew, how the meaning of the word Upanishad changed to some extent, how the reference of Vedanta changed to some extent. So I'll give you my sort of simplified reconstruction. Originally, there must have been a group of authors, persons, scholars who were making formulations of what the Veda was meant for. Initially, this could have been carried in an oral tradition, that's possible. But very soon, let's call them compositions rather than written texts, collecting this kind of ancient insight into what the Vedas were meant for came to be called Vedanta. The Upanishads, doing what we call Upanishads now in the Aranyakas, were essentially doing the same thing. So there was overlap in these two bodies of texts. So some Vedanta texts came to be designated as Upanishad and Aranyaka for some associations that must have existed in practice rather than in the description of the content of the work. So Aranyaka, a text actually giving you the teaching of the Veda, but which you are more likely to study in the forest dwelling stage, or which it was recommended to you that you should study them at a later stage in life. Some kind of purpose-driven designation or location-driven designation. About the word Upanishad, there's considerable difference of views. The old view that what you get by sitting next to the teacher is generally not accepted by Indologists these days. But if you think of the Upanishads as continuation of the Brahmanas, and it's really a new kind of symbolism, metaphysical and philosophical symbolism, complementing the symbolism in the Brahmanas, the ritualistic symbolism in the Brahmanas, if you take Upanishad in that way. It really does not make much of a difference. It's clearly not a designation given on the basis of what the texts are supposed to contain. It's really the manner of receiving them, or their style of expressing certain insights into the Veda. So even if we don't make a decision as to which interpretation of the word Upanishad is historically justified, we can be at least negatively sure that it's not a designation based on the content of the text. So Vedanta and Upanishad, having similar objective, seem to have overlapped at some point. And maybe this continued for a while. The Vedanta texts that became prestigious were included in the Vedic body as Upanishads. There was probably a great deal of variety of these texts, because Vedas have been interpreted in different ways from a very ancient time. So a great deal of variety must have existed. That is partly reflected in the Upanishads as we have them. You know, just as we have some with emphasis on sannyasa, some with emphasis on explication of secret meanings of earlier Vedic passages and so on, some emphasizing yoga, some incorporating an interesting stories such as Nachiketas and Jabala and so on. So we should imagine a much more diverse body in the earlier period. So this is, I think, this kind of dynamic between the two continued for a while, and then Vedanta as a separate tradition of texts seems to have disappeared. That is, because maybe the word had too general a meaning, then that might have worked against it. Okay, there is one very interesting problematic passage in the Brahma Sutra, the only passage where the word Vedanta occurs. Sarva Vedanta Pratyayam in Brahma Sutra 3.3.1. And Shankara and Ramanuja interpret it in essentially one way. The Madhva tradition interprets it in another way. I recently studied the problem here, because you have books, all of these handy. I think the Madhva tradition is closer to the truth in this particular case. That is, Sarva Vedanta Pratyayam is a compound, like the Mimamsa compound, Sarva Shakha Pratyayam Ekam Karma, means although there are verbal differences in the branches of the Veda, they all inform us about the same ritual act. You have to determine the nature of the ritual act by considering all these passages together and synthesizing them. The same message, I think, Badarayana has in this Vedanta Sutra, Sarva Vedanta Pratyayam. Brahma is one, which the nature of which is to be gathered by studying all Vedanta texts. I think that will be the most straightforward mean. Now, coming briefly to the implications, some of them I have already pointed out, so I will be very brief about them. One is why Bhava Viveka has this divided attitude toward the Vedanta Darshana. I think if we accept that a period in which the reference of Vedanta did not exactly coincide with the reference of Upanishad, we can see why an author would be writing the way he has written. The explication of this problematic Brahma Sutra is another gain. But I think the largest gain is that our attitude toward the Veda and toward the study of the Veda in traditional India must change. When Indology began, Buddhism has made too great an impact as a rational system at the expense of Brahmanism. That is, as if this is a religion which was completely rational, given to logic, did not accept scriptural authority. And then there were the Brahmins, who were mindlessly performing rituals. I'm not suggesting that, you know, expert scholars who are careful in their research are committing this mistake, but a perception is widespread that we have a sort of division between rational and non-rational. And the Brahmanical system may be of great importance to historical anthropologists, but it rarely, in the early system, it rarely has anything of interest to philosophers, because there is no emphasis on logic. And a verse like, you know, the tapa cheda cha nikasha suvarnamiva panditaha pariksha bhikshavo grahyam madvacho natu gauravad, this is ascribed to the Buddha, that even my statements you should examine on the touchstone of logic. Maybe early discovery by the Indologist of such statements has swung the balance too much in favor of Buddhism. And we have to imagine that the Brahmins were all the time carrying the activity of applying hermeneutics to Vedic texts to derive philosophical truths. They were engaged in this for a long time. And we should take seriously thinkers like Yaska, you know, who, and Bhartrihari, you know, who indicate that a triple interpretation of Veda was frequently carried out. It says, Eko mantro yathadhyatmam adhidaivam adhikratu. The same mantra can be interpreted in three different ways. Adhyatma in a metaphysical, spiritual sense. Adhidaiva as applying to gods, maybe in our terminology, mythological, theological. And as applying to the ritual action. So this kind of varied interpretational activity was going on from a very ancient time. And this must have involved rational thinking, debates, coming up with texts that tried to establish the meaning of the Veda from a particular point of view. This brings to me to my next, you know, this has significant implications for Indology as a whole, how we practice Indology. The other thing is the history of Indian philosophy. Minor incidents like a passage in the Vedanta Sutra or how Bhavya deals with something I've already mentioned. But coming to significant absences and presences in the history of Indian philosophy. In the early period, we do not find Sankhya being branded as non-Vedic. And there is no real evidence of a conflict between Sankhya and Vedanta. That is, because at some point in the Vedanta text, the text I have called Vedanta text, must have given a Sankhya interpretation also of the Vedic tradition, which we see partly preserved in an Upanishad like the Shvetashvatara Upanishad. But, you know, in the Mahabharata, Sankhya is not branded non-Vedic. Only when we come to a later period, Shankara says it's non-Vedic. And he also calls Sankhya Pradhanamalla. It's a mighty presence in the on the philosophical scene. Again, there must have been a tradition of according respect to Sankhya as one of the sub-schools in the Vedic family of thinking. And this is one probable explanation of the prestige of Sankhya and the loss of that prestige later on. Or perhaps you could think of other implications, but I'll stop here. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. I have some of my own questions, but I won't take the my being the chair of the session and use that, but I would first of all ask any responses or any comments or questions.
Please feel free, especially criticism. This is in the making. Yes.
Yeah, because I think as you have noticed, the implications is quite substantial, and it actually impinges on how we understand not only Vedanta vis-a-vis Indian philosophy, but also Hinduism and the study of Hinduism as such. And so the floor is open to questions. And
may I leave with an apology? I must leave shortly.
Okay.
Take your pardon. But I have a question. It's an apology. The Nyaya Kosha that you quote in Shiro Bhago, Shiro Bhaga, is there any sense of anta elsewhere as a shiras?
Oh, because if you say the real message of the Veda, the ultimate teaching of the Veda, then a claim of superiority is implicit, and that's why Shira.
Yeah, I understand. I was just curious if anta, meaning the end, ever physically.
But you'll see that Taranath Bhattacharya in his Shabda Stoma Nidhi and Jalkikar both do the same thing.
Both do, that's right.
Yeah, the same thing. Yeah. So it's their way of saying highest teaching. Yeah, that's it.
And then I
good.
That would be a kind of a symbolic meaning of Sira?
Yes. But now you see, anta means end, and the end of the body could be the head as well as the feet. So it's possible you may come across a passage where anta has to be interpreted as shiras, but normally no. That's not the way it's glossed.
I just want to. I know there are other questions coming. Just to kind of add to what you have said, as you were developing the argument, it struck me that indeed in the vernacular, and certainly in Telugu, that is how it is always. There are anta in a kind of spatio-temporal sense also is used, but in the sense of end or meaning, conclusion, intention, that is more predominant in our even in our casual conversation.
And you don't use Siddhanta, Radhanta, Kritanta, etc., these words?
We do.
Okay. No, what I mean is in other Indian languages, they will normally use this compound word.
Yes.
So that is, this is the Siddhanta.
It always comes in a compound.
Okay.
But the sense in which the word anta.
Yeah, then it's if they are using Siddha, Radha, or Krita, then it's not different from Sanskrit then.
Yeah.
Please.
We hear the term Neo Vedanta referring to that sort of discourse that comes up in the 19th and continues through to the present 19th century. So I'm just wondering, when you're speaking of implications of this understanding, are you saying that a present-day use of Vedanta in a popular sense is thoroughly misdirected? Are you saying that the application of the term is becoming muddled because of this understanding?
No, that is, any term that is used in many different contexts is going to have slightly different meanings. That is, this is a natural thing in language. So, I wouldn't deny the later, neo-Vedantins like Vivekananda and others. I think it was Hucker's term, neo-Vedanta, who used, maybe earlier, Paul Hucker. I wouldn't deny them the freedom. I would not say that they are misusing the term. My concern primarily has been with the earlier usage. If you in the implications, I again refer to Louis Renou. And Renou made a very significant observation, which is true to a considerable extent. But one still again has to decide at which level it's true, in which context it is true. That is, he said a recognition of the Veda in the Indian tradition is very much like tipping your hat when you pass by someone. you know, that is. So you show the respect, but you actually don't know what the Veda contains.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's true as we come ahead in time. That's, you will see countless preachers in regional languages in India. They will say, just as the Vedas say, and then they will quote a text which is either not Vedic or they will not quote a text at all. It's sufficient to say as the Vedas say. And one of my most interesting experiences was in Valsad, Gujarat. You know, as I was there, I went to a very beautiful Jain ashrama. It's called Trimuni Ashrama. And there are three Jain brothers who run it. And I stopped there to listen to the pravachana, you know, at that time. And then this Jain person began, "Jaisa ki hamare Vedo mein kaha hai," as has been said in our Vedas. Okay, so you see that it's not confined to the so-called Hindus, but it's quite widespread. You see it in the Sikh tradition. You see in the Sikh tradition, it's in fact much more common. So, if you connect this with this particular treatment of the Veda, behind which is the more significant recognition that you can rely on Veda to derive practically any philosophy you want. Whether people will accept that or not is another matter. But Veda, in theory, has to be accepted as the ultimate source of knowledge. And attaching something to Veda means considerable respectability. Saying that, instead of saying, "I thought of this," if you say, "This came out of the Veda when I was studying the Veda," or "from this Vedic passage," that always has meant something very important, significant in India. And that's, you know, a good principle of social management also in that, but much is achieved. For historically oriented scholars, this may be naivete, this may be missing the historical reality and so on. But if it makes people happy, why should historians stand in their way? You know, that's that is one concern. So if you connect it with the Neo-Vedantin thinking, with all these broader trends, then I would not say they are misusing the term or misleading the people. Yeah. They are doing what is quite traditionally respectable in India. Yes, why not? But the meaning, basic meaning, you know, teaching of the Veda is not changing. Mm. That's still constant. Mm. Yeah. Please, Professor Cousins.
The problem is with the word anta, isn't it? And that's, I mean, one question that arises is it simply, as the dictionary sometimes say, pleonastic in some cases at the end of compounds? And I think if one looks at all the many occurrences within compounds, it is difficult to believe that in all cases it's meaningful.
Can you give me concrete example? But for kammanta that has been sometimes said, correct? You just write action. Anta doesn't really add anything to its meaning.
Well, that would go for the Pali, I think. It's not convincing.
No, but
that adds anything to the Pali, but that wouldn't prove it doesn't somewhere else.
No, if you can think of other compounds like this, then it's...
I think one would need to survey the whole...
Yeah, I did a lot of these. That is, I looked at all the anta compounds using Vishwabandhu's index, you know, which there is a reverse index, which is very, very good for this. And Rukleifig's Wörter book that came from Vienna, you know, I looked up the words. Now, in the case of kammanto or karmanto also, you know, the thing is, because people could not determine the meaning, they are saying it's used just as a filler. Mm-hmm. But suppose you studied these words comparatively, and they say the meaning was action with discrimination, action with some kind of determination in mind, then it would fit. Action preceded by, you know, or followed by proper discrimination.
Following intention.
Would fit. So, you know, every time we have to look up if some historical explanation or position has been taken because of helplessness, or with new evidence we could give it up.
I looked up the Pali Dictionary this morning just out of interest to see what they said. And they differ on the matter.
Yes.
You see, PD, that's A. I mean, you must have looked at it, but it, the end of a compound in some instances apparently pleonastic, but probably giving a more concrete sense, including completion, entirety, or system of something. Which does support your position to some extent, but it really would need, I think, it really does need the study of all the cases, or as many cases as possible, to establish it. My own hesitation was to wonder whether or not, in fact, the term isn't, in fact, extracted from Vedantaka, or Vedantaku in Pali, where it would simply mean mastering the Vedas, but then it's very natural for if that occurs in verses that are well known, somebody's then going to suppose the Vedanta has meaning there, as a mastering the Vedanta rather than mastering the Veda. But it may be that some of the examples you were giving are rather too early for that possibility.
That is, the meaning of Karmanta influenced by the meaning of Vedanta in Vedantagu, etc.?
Leaving aside Karmanta, but Vedantaga, where verses. I mean, that's very quite early. I mean, the Pali.
Yes, Sutta Nipata
has it.
Yes.
And so on. There it must mean mastering the, having gone to the end of the Vedas in the sense of having thoroughly mastered the Vedas. I wouldn't think it's in
Well, this again I see as an instance of same type of instance. That is, because people started with the idea that the Buddha had no respect, particular respect for the Vedas, he wanted to be away from scriptures. These meanings have been proposed. But when he has, you see, verbal mastery of the Veda in mind, knowing the Veda as a text, the Pali uses Tinnam Vedanam Paragu. So there must be. And the Mahabharata has exactly parallel passages with Vedantaga and Vedantagu. You see, Mahabharata uses Vedantaga.
Yeah, but Vedagu probably is Prakritism for Vedaka.
The historical derivation of the word is difficult and undecided. That is, the morphology is problematic.
Yeah.
But, see, Gu. I cannot prove it through historical linguistics, you know, the little knowledge I have of it, but Vedajna is a possible meaning. Vedajna and Vedantajna.
I think people wanted to assimilate it to that for a long period, but it's much more likely that it's a proper remnant from the voicing of the K.
Okay. Yeah. Then Vedak, if you take that, then Vedaka is a Veda reciter, that is true. But what would be the Vedanta reciter? Because Vedanta Gu also occurs. See, Gu coming from root Gu in the sense of
Vedanta Ga in the epic.
Yes.
The Gu is simply for Ga.
Yes, that's what I would say. And so my simple explanation would be its root Gama, you know, and used in the sense of going over, knowing, you know, in that sense. That is, but I wasn't aware of this Kogu business. I just thought Vedajna was suggested, but that Vedagyo pronounced as Vedagyo.
It could be either in principle. You have to look at the actual passages.
Correct.
But I think there's enough reason there to think that it's probably Vedaka, the actual cases. It doesn't necessarily, you have to be careful because therefore Veda has so many meanings.
Yes. But if the etymology is doubtful, you will give me the freedom to swing it this way.
I think the reason why we don't want to.
As one of the things among many. That is, sorry, please go ahead.
Perhaps two things. First, I found it quite puzzling that if really, as you said, Vedanta would refer to, have referred at some point to a large body of texts other than the Upanishads, that early Advaitins or non-Advaitins, and obviously the others would be Advaitins, like Gaudapada, Shankara, would not switch for Acharya, so the prominent writers would not have mentioned anything about, or would not have been aware of the existence of such texts. That sounds pretty, likely to me, because they do spend so much energy, so much writing in trying to defend, the Siddhanta in the face of all the schools that were, prominent enough to be taken up for examination and verification. So, anyway, that's the first thing. I'm still a bit puzzled about that, even though on a linguistic basis you seem to, bring forward a lot of really good arguments.
Should I first respond to that and then come here? The thing is, first of all, in historical research, absence is rarely a convincing argument. That is absent. The second thing is, if these texts existed in, say, 5th, 6th century B.C., or maybe 8th century B.C., who knows? That is the early, when the Upanishads begin to separate, which would be the time of the end of the Brihadaranyaka and Chandogya, then it's not surprising they would not come down. Whatever was frequently studied and became popular survived. Secondly, the other traditions of Vedanta, Ramanuja and others, do make a claim of going back to the pre-Shankara tradition. Especially Ramanuja is quite explicit on that. He says, I am representing Bodhayana.
Yes.
So, and he cites some passages.
I mean, in this respect, then we have to look at Buddhist and China literature, which obviously always speak of Upanishad Advaitins as some kind of non-dual interpretation. There's never any...
That has been a dominant, school. Yeah. Yes, that's true. But if other schools, other thinkers had also realized that there is great social possibility for social acceptance, larger following, by claiming origin for one's thinking in the Veda, then they also must have tried, as Madhva later on did try. Correct? So, and finally, one thing I would mention, the early authors frequently use Vedanta in the plural. Vedanteshu. Gaudapada uses in the plural. So, Mandana Mishra frequently uses in the plural. I didn't have time to study all the occurrences. In many cases, one has to read the whole text carefully. If an electronic text is available, this has become considerably easy now. But I checked, Gaudapada and Mandana. And so the plural probably refers to this fact that there were several texts trying to determine the meaning. And of course, the texts that gave the Advaita message were a favorite of these authors.
But is the plural not, I don't know if it, how substantial it is. I mean, there were obviously many Upanishadic texts as well.
Correct.
Even though it's often named Upanishad, but I don't know if that.
No, you raise a very important point, but what I'm saying is it would, in the present state of our resources, it would not prove one way or the other, not because it's basically an absence-based argument. What is your second?
The other thing was just, was interesting what you say about the distinction between Upanishad and Vedanta, again, as them not necessarily meaning, again, one and the same meaning. Perhaps also the reference you made to the Upanishad as the metaphysical and metaphorical continuity of the Veda. Now, to me, if we look, perhaps historically we can reconstruct such a history, but it seems to me like within the Upanishad themselves, we do have this clear distinction of an ultimate Siddhanta, which we mean Vedanta, and a non-ultimate one, the distinction we find in between a Pravriti and Nivriti Dharma. Or in Katha Upanishad, the distinction between Shreyasa and Priyasa. Priyasa referring obviously to the fruit that one gets from accomplishing rituals, and Shrestha from the Gyana that you get from the Upanishadic text, or the I think it's the Yajnavalkya's teaching, the Upanishada Purusha that is spoken of. This is the Purusha that's only taught in the Upanishad, nowhere else. Again, referring to an ultimate you know, teaching, which shows already that the meaning of Vedanta was already there, at least in a seed form in the Upanishad, and that I think it's very easy. I mean, I don't know if it necessarily used to be an overlap of two different things, or just kind of like the meaning of Vedanta branching off from the Upanishad from within, rather. Just on the basis of this kind of evidence that we would find in the Upanishad themselves.
Okay, well, you ask a rather complex question. Let me begin at a different starting point. First of all, generally in ancient literature, in Sanskrit ancient literature, and true of most ancient literatures, we don't have perfect synonyms. So there has to be some difference of connotation between Upanishad and Vedanta. And I tried to explain it in terms of the location or the method of imparting or style of composition and so on. But there is the meaning that continues all along with Upanishad is not the very literal one sitting next to, but it is something secret, something to be selectively given. That is common throughout. So it must have been precious knowledge of some type. That's another way of distinguishing between Vedanta and Upanishad. Okay, that is the Upanishad. I'm not saying that the Upanishad covered all of Vedanta or Vedanta covered all of Upanishad. They had different purposes to some extent, different emphasis. And the emphasis on being precious, rare, something to be selectively given, is part of the meaning of the word Upanishad. It might not have been a part of the meaning of the word Vedanta. Okay. Now, the Purushadvaita became the most dominant representative of the Upanishadic tradition. There's no doubt. That is, Bhavya really speaks of Purushadvaita. But we have older authors than Bhavya who speak of Saptadvaita. You know, not in those terms, but who have the doctrine of Saptadvaita. In fact, Advaita tends to be used in so many different combinations like this. Bhavadvaita, Sattadvaita, Purushadvaita, Atmadvaita. And sometimes the terms are, in the later period, just synonymous. Sometimes there are important philosophical differences. Sattadvaita and Atmadvaita are not different. Are different, I mean. And Mandana, for example, can be interpreted much better as a Sattadvaitavadi, as a senior of Shankara, than as an Atmadvaitavadin. But there are, in some cases, Atmadvaita and Purushadvaita, there may not be a philosophical difference, there may be just a difference of terminology, that's possible. In fact, these Advaitas become so, you know, so many compounds, that this Jain author, Prabhachandra, actually has a pun based on it. And he says, people were making a lot of noise and you could not hear what someone was speaking. You know, it just became pandemonium. He says, Shabdadvaitam iva abhavat. You know, he says, poking fun at the grammarians and saying, yes, no one could distinguish all the words that were being articulated. So you do have this kind of difference. Now, what I'm saying is, given the later evidence, we should imagine a greater variety of Vedic interpretations subsumed under Vedanta, some of which coincided with what the Upanishads bring down to us, some of which had a very different emphasis. And it could be that there was a Sankhya Vedanta, there was a Yoga Vedanta. And what we call later Upanishads now, may have had early antecedents. And as I said in your response to your first comment, maybe some of these are lost, because this process of preserving a later, more convenient text and ignoring the earlier text is very common. And to some extent it was forced upon the people by circumstances. I don't think they deliberately did it, but it's just like our rare books.
Linguistic simplification.
Yes.
And we have just really shown more than a possibility.
Of
the possibility that an earlier Vedanta literature, separate Vedanta literature occurred, as opposed to a probability or a certainty.
As for that particular aspect,
really go beyond that.
No, for that particular part of my reconstruction, probability. Because unless I come across a text, you know, that says